This comment was on our fifth broadcast on defense of patenting and the harms of intellectual property, and the comment reads as follows. While there are certainly lots of draconian copyright laws and regulations that get in the way of creativity, which most certainly need to be done away with, I think in some cases the lack of intellectual property rights can harm the incentives. For example, in a world without intellectual property rights, what incentive is there to make a multi-million-dollar movie if it's going to be distributed freely on the internet with little to no payback? Now, I think there are many ways to earn money off of a work, even without intellectual property rights
Certainly.
Associated with it.
And I think there are a few presuppositions in that statement also that need to be discussed before we step forward. That is, the idea that the only really good movie would be a multi-million-dollar movie seems to me very fallacious.
Right. There are so many technologies today that can facilitate very inexpensive movie making quality.
You could say the same thing about computer games. You see a ton of web series and things like this. The best one I can think of is Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. It cost quite little to produce. Certainly no multi-million dollar production. And it was done with people who had amazing credits, of course, but they didn't get paid that much. And they mostly did it out of fun and love, and they released it on the internet. And how did they make their money? Not by charging people absurd amounts to go to movie theaters. They released it for free on the internet for viewing when it first came out, and it's free again now that it's been out for a while. You can still go and buy it on iTunes, which I did shortly after it was released because I wanted to have a hard copy on my hard drive. You could buy the soundtrack, you could buy various pieces of swag like t-shirts and hats, and eventually you could buy the DVD, and I ended up doing that too, in a physical copy for a Christmas present for my family. So just because it's released for free on the internet, and just because it doesn't cost millions of dollars to make, doesn't mean you won't achieve something incredible. In fact, if you can lower the barriers to entry so that creating something great doesn't cost many millions of dollars, everyone will be better off.
Yes, even if one is going for a lot of special effects that impress people,
that doesn't
necessarily require money either. It requires some skill. Yes.
Yeah. And it may require a little bit of sweet-talking to get someone with that kind of skill to help you out, or just a project that that person would love working on and would be willing to exchange that or maybe trade favors with you or something in order to work on this project. Another example is Napoleon Dynamite, which I know is kind of a hit-or-miss film for some people, but I loved it. I know it was a long time ago now that it was made, but it's still one of my favorite absurd little comedies. And it didn't cost a huge amount of money to make either, and it's still well done and unique, you know, and was a massive success. It doesn't quite parallel with Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, since it wasn't released for free on the internet in the same way, but there are lots and lots of musicians and creators now who are releasing their stuff for free first, and then taking donations, for example, or putting up things that you can buy for a little extra, like higher quality versions of the recordings that you could go purchase if you're an audiophile, something like that.
Yes, and then there's also always patronage.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody could just pay a lump sum to get a work out there, and like the patrons of old, some patrons might be concerned with personal prestige. Having sponsored a work and released it into the world would be enough for them to essentially advance their good name.
You see a little bit of this with people like Richard Branson.
Yes.
Richard Branson has done something similar to this with these non-NASA space programs, sorts of things.
Yes.
Because Richard Branson wants to be the guy who did that, you know? And it's scientific patronage rather than artistic patronage, but it's the same urge.
I think that's a good point, because it doesn't have to be limited to art, music, and movies, to media that are copyrighted. It can also be extended just as successfully to technologies that can be patented.
Mm-hmm.
The same patronage can motivate that kind of advancement as well. Also, with the internet, with PayPal, with easy ways of giving money to people, one could conceive of a system of micro-patronage where...
Well, that's what we're seeing now. We call it crowdsourcing, in a way. I mean, if you can get a $5 donation from 1,000 people, you're in business for a month or 2 months or however long you can make that amount of money stretch.
Yes.
And it's a different method, but yeah, if you can have the crowd be your patron rather than one extremely wealthy individual, maybe you can get something off the ground.
Yes. It's interesting. Ludwig von Mises wrote that in the market, every dollar is a vote, essentially.
He also joked that not enough people were interested in opera, so the government should subsidize it.
But he didn't know about the internet and how the internet has really worked wonders for the availability of high culture.
Yes.
So I think he would have been a little more optimistic here. Now, it's true that many people aren't making fortunes off of distributing classical music on the internet, but there are enough people who are just sheerly enthusiastic about it that this music, I think, is having a resurgence.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many, many options, especially with today's technology.
Yes. I'd like to address one last fallacy that I think is in this comment, and that's the idea that lack of intellectual property rights harms incentives for people to create. Actually, if you look at certain historical incidents, for example, Verdi. Verdi was an amazing opera writer. Look him up on Wikipedia if you haven't seen what he's done. But he was extraordinarily prolific for the first half of his career, basically. And then he got, well, at that point in time, intellectual property rights were just making their way onto the scene, and he got copyright to his works. He suddenly became extraordinarily picky about what he would or would not create, and began living simply off of the royalties of what he'd already created. And his rate of productivity went down to almost nil.
Yes.
After that point, he produced maybe 3 or 4 operas, which, if you look at what he had produced up to that point, it's astounding, the difference in productivity. And some people say, well, now he can just do what he enjoys and takes on the projects he likes best. But at that point, you've already given up the argument saying that productivity is encouraged by copyright, because it's not.
Right, right. What's encouraged is resting on one's laurels, and also...
And, I mean, if you want to say there's a value in that, you can. But you have to change the terms of your argument.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say that being able to rest on your laurels will make you more productive. You might try saying that resting on your laurels makes you create higher quality individual works, but that's questionable. Again, comparing the quality of Verdi's earlier versus later works.
Yes. Well, in the intellectual property era, there has come to be this big hit mentality, the idea that every artist tries to create just one work for which they will be eternally remembered, and it's the greatest work ever, and many of these artists or writers have spent decades, literally decades, refining one particular work before they released it to the public, and then they hope to make it big, but it's a hit or miss, and most often it's a miss.
I think the problem is the way we think about art historically. We're often very mistaken about the number of great works an artist has. Because of the way our minds work, we think, oh, Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel, or Michelangelo and David. And you'll think of like 1 or 2 great works by an artist. But then if you go and actually look at their catalogs, I mean, you think Da Vinci and the Mona Lisa, right? Go and look at what they actually created.
Yes.
And you'll find that they have hundreds of works, if not thousands in the case of someone like Da Vinci.
Mm-hmm.
And that dozens of those were actually masterpieces.
Right.
And the reason we only remember 1 or 2 is because of our limited memories, not because people didn't try to create as many as they could.
Right. I think the best way to achieve success in that kind of field, or in any field, really, is to produce a lot. And I think...
Well, you're certainly doing well on that front.
Yes, well, I have over 1,000 articles to my name.
That's something to be proud of.
Mm-hmm. And I think my work is of high quality, high enough that I would render it available to the public. But I don't look at each work and say, well, this is it. This is the essence of the best possible art, and I couldn't ever conceivably make it better.
Right, and I think that that's a very realistic perspective that you're taking. The other way of looking at it, where you have, oh, this is my highest achievement, it is my magnum opus, it is an extraordinarily romantic way of looking at the world. Not that that's always a bad thing, but it's not realistic, and it can lead to a kind of sine wave of highs and lows of your mood, a kind of manic depression.
Well, even Ayn Rand fell prey to that after Atlas Shrugged, essentially.
Ayn Rand had other mental problems.
Well, when she wrote Atlas Shrugged, she thought, well, this was her magnum opus, it was going to change the world. And she did have plans for some other fictional works.
Again, unrealistic expectations.
When those expectations failed to be met, she really abandoned her fiction writing altogether, and she didn't look into her other planned projects, perhaps as much as she should have, because she thought, well, I already already wrote Atlas Shrugged. Nothing could beat that. And that's definitely a very mistaken view. I wish
it
he had written more...
It is a mistaken view. The Fountainhead is much better than Atlas Shrugged.
Well, I do wish Ayn Rand had written more fiction, especially since she thought of herself as a novelist first and then as a philosopher.
You know, it's funny. I think the shorter the Ayn Rand novel is, the better it is, to be honest. I know that she thinks that Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged are her best works, but I would actually put their quality in reverse order of their length. That is, I prefer Anthem to The Fountainhead to Atlas Shrugged, because in Anthem she really distilled her message to its essence, this message of individual achievement and individual freedom. And the more detail and depth she tried to put into it, the more she diluted that message. So while she has more things to say in Atlas Shrugged, I actually think Anthem is a much more effective piece of fiction.